The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Joining us on the line now is Thomas S. Mullaney. He's Professor of History at Stanford University and a leading scholar of the history of technology and information. He is the award-winning author of various books, his latest being How We Disappear, A Personal History of Information. The book begins with the death of Mullaney's father and expands into the question, what actually survives us? Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. First of all, I'm sorry to hear of the passing of your father.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
And why was it that moment got you thinking about the information that survives us? Because I admit it's something I've thought about a lot, or our information both online and also photographs and paperwork and things like that.
Yeah, well, for me, I've been a professional historian. I've been on the faculty at Stanford for 20 years. So I've spent my whole career traveling to archives and looking at what is left behind in the lives of other people. So I've worked in 100 plus archives in 20 countries, but I've always been studying, I guess a way to put it is someone outside of myself, someone out there on the other side of the world or have you. And I think going through my father's room, which also doubled as his office after his death, my professional life sort of came crashing through the walls and windows and became instantly very, very personal. So on the one hand, I recognize how hard it is to piece together, in this case, this person who is now gone, my father, trying to understand him. But of course, it's something that I spend every waking Monday through Friday thinking about. So the professional and the personal kind of smash together all at one moment. And I think that was the beginning of when I decided to sit down and start writing this book.
Yeah, it's very difficult getting rid of stuff when a loved one dies. I've experienced with the loss of my mother a few years ago.
And I'm sorry.
Thank you. In one way, you can be quite practical. I mean, everybody's different, obviously, but you can be quite practical and think, okay, this is something she used that we don't need, or, you know, and start thinking, well, that would be fine for charity shops. That would be, you know, and you can start getting rid of stuff. But then obviously the emotional side of you can easily take over, where you want to keep everything because you start thinking, this meant something to her, so it should mean something to me. How could I possibly get rid of it? It's a very difficult process, isn't it?
It is, because I agree entirely. There's that instinct to sort of freeze it in time. And, you know, if only all of us could freeze, you know, this is Benjamin Franklin's house and home and study and turn it into a museum that then you can visit anytime you want and see everything exactly where it was. But of course, that kind of privilege is reserved for exceedingly few. And even in those cases, you know, you visit the family home of XYZ and it's kind of it's kind of a myth. It's kind of a Disneyland version of probably what their life was like. But for, you know, the 99.999% of rest of us, we have to make those decisions. We have to give away. We have to bring things to the dump. We have to make all of these, and we have to make them very fast. Often death comes, and that kind of process can lead to value judgments and decisions that take place over the course of a day, a week. Even when you prolong it and you don't want to take care of it, when you do, you have to make these judgments one after the next, after the next, after the next. And it's very confusing.
Yeah. The online presence is an interesting thing. Thinking of Facebook, for example, when people die and they had a Facebook profile, if they didn't close down their Facebook profile before they died, which has to be quite a bit of, I guess, planning to do that. And I suppose most people don't do that. You get a reminder every year on their birthday. which is interesting, which some people quite like. Some people, it really upsets them. Some people, which can be weird, might not know that they died. So 3 years later, they're going, happy birthday, hope you have a great day. And that can be quite upsetting to see. So that's a really interesting. I personally quite like it because I like getting these memories that come up. And it's, yeah, I think it's lovely.
Yeah, there is. I mean, our lives in the last 15, 20 years, our experience of death is always connected to technology. So there's, you know, there's some brilliant scholarship that looks at the early history of telegraphy and telephone systems. And, you know, back when this was a radically new technology, and there were, you could say, kind of religious cults that emerged where people were convinced that in the kind of noise of the telephone line, the noise of the telegraph line, that they could commune with the dead, that there was some sort of, that there was, that this technology was in some way changing what happens in our ability to commune with deceased loved ones. So it's always been our relationship with death, what gets remembered, how we try to deal with it's always been tied up with Bell Atlantic and Samuel Morse, and now with Mark Zuckerberg, and you know, that's that death is very technological, and it has been, you know, since we've been tool using organisms, tool using humans.
Yeah, I remember reading something a while ago. It might have been about Bruce Willis, but it might not. So I should mention a name. But it was somebody like that who was talking about passing their Apple playlist onto their kids. So when they died, it would automatically go to them, and they weren't allowed to do it. It wasn't possible to pass your Apple Music list that you would have traditionally paid for over the years, because that's how it always worked. You couldn't change the details to pass it on to your kids, for example. And I found that really odd.
That makes me so, I was, as you began to tell that story, I was getting very happy. And I thought, what a lovely, you know, thing that technology enables. And then boom, you brought the lever down. No, someone asked, and I had a lovely conversation around the book, and naturally the question came up of what strategies can one use to stave this off? Or I think the better way to put it is, how can we delay the inevitable? Because we have to remember, there's no bypassing the second law of thermodynamics. There is no bypassing that story. But the time scale of the death of the universe is unimaginable to us. Like, we obviously live in timescales of a human life, maybe 2-3 generations. That's generally the envelope of time where most human imagination happens. For an historian, we tend to think in 500-year chunks, and that's why we're able to see these processes. But there are things that can be done that give a fighting chance for the next of kin or even grandchildren to understand orders of magnitude more about you and your life and your current life than might otherwise happen. And I really like this idea of thinking of a playlist as something that you could give. Maybe you'd have to transcribe it, and, you know, they would have to reconstruct it. I guess Apple doesn't allow you to do it. But my goodness, if I had the counterpart of my dad's playlist, that, I still remember one time being in the car with him, and he was a sort of a reserved guy. In some sense, he whistled for much of my childhood, and then he stopped, and I never knew why. But one day we were in the car, and like Creedence Clearwater Revival came on, and he started singing with the radio. And for a moment, he wasn't my dad. He was just this older guy in the seat next to me, living his life and being, you know, tapping into himself. And in that, I think in those, it was probably the tail end of the song, in those 60 seconds, I learned more about my dad than I probably did in the preceding 5 years of him performing the role of dad. So my goodness, if I had his playlist, like what he rocked out to in the 50s and the 60s, I don't know what I would pay for that. I would I, you know, I'd have my kids. I would reconsider the tuition plan for my kids if I could get my hands on something like that.
Oh, lovely. And the interesting thing about online information is obviously passwords and how we've been told our whole lives. I remember my mum always saying to me, never share your passwords, even with your boyfriend or whoever you marry, because you never know how things may or may not turn out. You know, you can't trust anyone when it comes to passwords. But then, of course, when that person dies, if nobody has access to their passwords, not only are you thinking playlists, emails, but bank details. I mean, the list is endless what we have passwords for. The idea of not being able to access any of our loved ones' information after they've died is quite scary.
Yes. And if anyone has, I'm not saying anyone sits around wondering what a professional historian does, but if the paperwork of death, and for any listener who has lost a loved one knows this and was in charge of the paperwork of that moment, knows that what you're doing is you are writing letters to, banks and telephone companies and producing proof of death, and upon production of proof of death, gaining access to social media accounts and the sort of bureaucracy and paperwork of putting affairs in order after death is very similar to what we as historians do, but for other people outside of our own families. Like we are, you know, we ferret, we do the equivalent for people that are 200 years deceased. We ferret through their trash. We ferret through their wallets. We try to find the password that unlocks this and reconstruct and so forth. But then, of course, to your first question, suddenly when it comes crashing through the window and it's your father, and then later your mother, my brother handled most of all of that. When my mother passed, I was very grateful to him for he really led the charge in all of the paperwork of her death. But it's this bizarre mixture of this is very familiar to me that I know how to do this. And it is strange to be on, you know, listening to Muzak as I wait for the 800 number operator to come back on the phone to have a conversation with them about how my father died and I need access to X, Y, or Z. So it's uncanny.
Yeah. And cruel. It's horrible to have to go through all that when you're grieving. It's something that most people don't think about either. You know, obviously if it's a tragic death and then you're completely unprepared, but if you're, you know, nursing your loved one as they're dying, it's you're focusing generally on that moment and the emotions of that moment. And then when the moment actually happens, the idea of having to think about paperwork and sitting on hold to a bank is like the last thing you want to do. And then you have to keep saying it out loud what's happened, which is really tough.
It is tough. The one redeeming, and of course, you know, one only goes through this so many times in one's life. But the one thing that I would say is, I've never experienced humanity shining through like this, the sincerity of the operator's voice when saying, I am so sorry. And yes, I will help you with this ridiculous, mundane thing of getting access to this insurance policy. You know, you never were trained to think of whoever's on the other end of all of our bank teller and whatever calls as, you know, but then there's like there's this amazing humanity that comes just gushing through the telephone line in these conversations. And that was, wow, that was just little doses of peace in, you know, a week of lack of sleep and confusion and sadness. So that was the redeeming quality. I just was, and I talk about this in the book, you know, I don't know. And I decide to maintain in my mind, you know, the story I like to tell myself, but in truth, the nurses really went out of their way to, they wanted, well beyond probably medical reason, to be continuing to try to resuscitate my dad so that we, my mom and I, could get there in time to witness that.
Right.
So they were just absolutely exhausted. Talk about, they were like, they had just finished 3 Ironman competitions by the time we arrived. And I've always admired doctors, and especially after COVID, they just became otherworldly as saints to me. But that was the redeeming sense. It's just, you really had these unbelievable reconnections to the goodness of humankind in that. That was a little bit of solace.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. It's amazing when you're going through some of the hardest moments of your life, how these little moments can really, really help.
Definitely.
And as well as online, the online footprint, we've also got family photos, how they used to happen when we used to get them printed. And often mm-hmm. people have got albums, ideally with things labelled, but a lot of the time there might be boxes and boxes of photographs with nothing written on the back. And you can find yourself, it's all very well if it's a family holiday that you were on, but sometimes you can find yourself looking at photos having no idea of who you're looking at, and that's really difficult. Absolutely. As well.
That's to me one of the that's one of the epitome kind of moments for me in thinking about the book and episodes in it. Is so the book is how we disappear, right? So it sounds as if I would, that most likely I'm talking about literally photographs fading to darkness or paper crumbling into dust and so forth. I'm not talking about that. I have all of these photos. Many, many listeners will have intact the physical artifact. And yet the way things, at least in the more immediate sort of time scale of a human life, the way things actually disappear more often than not is not things going up in flames or crumbling into dust. It's all of that unwritten information that is encoded in our minds, in our bodies, in our just our know-how. I know who the, I know I have a photo on my office and in our home of my family and my kids and my mother-in-law and my mother and my father and I know who they are. The thought that I would right underneath their names, all of their names would be preposterous until the day comes when, my children after, after I'm gone are looking at that. And because all of that unwritten information is now gone, be in the same situation that I certainly in, where I see these photos, like, who is that person who kind of looks like dad but isn't? Who is that person who kind of looks like mom and isn't? It might as well be a box of photos from a thrift store in Nebraska. And that's what goes missing first, even if the physical artifacts survive.
Yeah. And it's a very personal thing as to whether you're quite happy to look at these photos and go, you know what, I don't know who these people are, therefore I'm not going to keep them. Or whether you look at them and you think, it's someone who looked like dad, so it was obviously related to dad, so they presumably meant something to him, so I should keep it. And again, there's a difference between keeping one or two of those photos compared to boxes and boxes of them. Because how often are we getting these photos out and looking through them, even photos of us in them from our own childhood holidays? How often do we get them out and trawl through them? It's such a fascinating process, ongoing process, I think, to go through.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, and again, to come back to the profession of history and archives, these massive collections of photographs and artifacts, and then of course museums and so forth. What basically archives are is you're preserving the possibility that someone in the future you have never met will come and set about interpreting something in that collection. You know, so it's you're preserving basically a condition of possibility that maybe something in this collection might offer insight and to someone asking a particular, you know, set of questions. But the average person, we don't have at our disposal miles and miles of shelf space to preserve the possibility that maybe at some point in the future, it may not be me, but maybe someone will take this box of photos out and actually have the missing key that unlocks who that person who looks like Dad is. And it turns out that they were so-and-so and that they lived this kind of life and I want to write about them or make a documentary or whatever. You know, we have to, like you said, more often than not, we have to make decisions to the extent of I'll keep three and get rid of the rest. Mm. I'll keep one and get rid of the rest. And I don't, you know, I, as an historian, you hope and want, you know, it's selfish. You hope and want people all over the world to live their lives so that your job gets easier. Please, everybody, label everything, keep everything, don't throw it out. And then you go through it and you're like, well, what an unreasonable demand of humankind. It's just not possible to do. And so you got to cut us human beings some slack for. We got to get through the day first and foremost. History comes after.
Yeah. I've interviewed many people over the years who have, exactly what you say, who have written books about forgotten people of history, a lot of them women, because they weren't documented or celebrated as much as men hundreds of years ago. And so often they, you know, I say, how easy was it to find information about this person? And sometimes easy, sometimes not much at all. They end up turning it into a novel because there isn't enough information to write a proper historical book on that person. So it's weird, isn't it, to think why people in years to come might want to find out information about us particularly, or our parents or our loved ones. It's a really strange thing.
I mean, when you're a historian of the modern period, you have the benefit of I stalk next of kin all the time. Like, I will find, you know, in the white pages and the yellow pages, I have made hundreds of calls and emails that amount to, hello, my name is Tom Mullaney. I'm a professor at Stanford. I'm working on a project. Pardon this interruption, and I may be wrong. Was your grandfather so-and-so who worked, you know, and so-and-so? And, you know, again, about 99% of the time I have it right. And there's this sort of deep interest of, wow, you know, I did not know that my grandfather would show up in a work of history somewhere. But there was one family I reached out to, and it was, they said, yes, that is us. And yes, that was my great grandfather. And as it stands, my daughter, for National History Day, is doing a project on her great, great, great grandfather. And so, you know, it's the thought, though. Like, if later in life I got an email or a phone call out of the blue saying, hi, my name is so-and-so and I'm a professor at, you know, Cambridge or University of Michigan or wherever they are, saying I'm working on the history of MCI and the history of the telephone, you know, and so forth. And I know your father was a salesman for MCI. I found some papers of his in the MCI archives and I had some questions for you. I think I would just start crying.
Yeah.
But it happens. This happens a lot. No one would ever, unless they're an ego, you know, egomaniacal person, yes, would never assume that you're going to get that call.
Yeah, exactly. One day people will write books about me.
Yeah.
And has the, because of being a historian and all the historical research you've done over the years, did the loss of your own parents make you think differently about memory and legacy and things like that?
Utterly different. Yeah, I, you know, alluding back to what I just said, I think when I started, over the course of the book, there is something revealed about my mother. She had sort of concealed a very important part of our family history. And I learned about it just before she died. And I write about it in the book. And I think the previous Tom Mullaney, me before writing this book, my flag is the flag of history, and I make all sorts of, you know, claims probably at that time of the right to know that they're, you know, the historian, our job is to go back into, you know, lost worlds, lost peoples and concepts and so forth. And, you know, as long as we follow the law, we're not breaking into anyone's email address. We're not, you know, doing a phishing attack on someone. As long as we follow the general protocols, we have some fundamental right to know the past, and anything that stands in our way is in contravention to that. Over the course of writing this, though, I have really come to a different, I think, ending point, which is, it is extremely hard for every human being to get through Monday, to get through Tuesday. The keeping information of everyday life is nothing to sneeze at. It is an enormous undertaking. I'm talking at like the atomic level, the cellular level, the molecular level, but also at the conceptual, the emotional level. It is nothing to just take for granted. And then comes the information of history, that is finding sources and documenting it, all that work that goes into keeping the past intact in some way. And so I discovered the facts of my mom's secret, but I never actually discovered the real secret, which is why she decided to conceal this secret from everyone in the first place. She did succeed in bringing that to the grave, and I will never know that. Previous Tom would have felt fundamentally kind of almost angry about that. You know, the historian has the right to know, and I, as your son, I have the right to know. Like, why? How is it that this can be denied to me? But the conclusion I've come to, and I talk about this in the book, is I'm pretty confident that with the energy that my mom put into this concealment, it was something she needed to get through her day.
Yeah.
I have tons of things that I need in terms of my ego, my identity, the story I tell myself of who I am. I have lots of things that help me get through Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I would feel strange if another person said, give up, you know, surrender all of those because I want to know X, Y, or Z about you. So I, you know, she needed what she needed to get through her day. The cost of that is that I will forever not know certain aspects of her and certain aspects of myself. But I have kind of come to peace with that, because the information of life comes before the information of history. And as I talk about it in the book, what it takes to keep life together and what it takes to keep history together are more often than not at odds with each other. Mm. There is a trade-off. If you choose one, you can't do the other. And if you choose one, you can't do the other. But life has to come first by definition. The present has to come first.
Yeah. Beautifully summarized. It's been amazing chatting with you, Thomas Mullaney. Thank you so much for joining us. And if listeners want to get a copy of your book, it's called How We Disappear, A Personal History of Information. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.